Professor Moorman, before we start, can you explain what is dry calving?
Certainly. So when a glacier is flowing down a valley, it can move in a number of different ways. It can slide over the bottom of the ground, or it can deform internally. But when it comes to the terminus, sometimes it just melts away. Other times it actually, the front breaks off and falls to the ground and has sort of like crumbling into a bunch of little pieces. This can happen on land, or this can happen if it flows out into the ocean, and that's where icebergs are formed when it calves into the ocean. We call that wet calving. If it breaks off on and just lands on land, we call it dry calving.
Now, you are researching ice loss in Arctic glaciers. How are you using the Canadian Space Agency's satellites to do this?
So the Canadian Space Agency's launched a couple of satellites that are very good for mapping the Arctic areas, and the most recent one allows us to map it with really great precision using a technique called interferometry. And so we can monitor not only how fast glaciers are moving and how much they're shrinking, but also we're hoping to be able to show that we'll be able to measure how much of the ice is crumbling off the front to how much of this dry calving is occurring.
Why is this important to research?
Well, the dry calving is important because with warming climates, glaciers are melting. That meltwater flows into the ocean and ultimately results in sea level rise. We've got a fairly good handle on how much glaciers are melting just through the normal melt processes. The glaciers that calve into the ocean, well, those icebergs are already floating, so they don't add to sea level. But this dry calving does something different. It breaks the glacier up into a bunch of small pieces that we think will melt much faster. If you think of putting an ice cube on your kitchen counter and watching it melt, well, if you then take a hammer to it and smash it into a bunch of little pieces, you see that it melts much faster. So this dry calving results in water being introduced into the ocean and adding to sea level rise in a much much quicker than it would otherwise.
Where in Canada's north are you observing these glaciers?
So our first study site is on Bylot Island, which is a small island just north of Baffin Island and just west of Greenland. And it's got this huge ice field with glaciers that flow out in all directions towards the ocean. And it's part of a mountain chain that goes all the way from southern Baffin Island all the way up to northern Ellesmere Island that has large ice fields, ice caps, and glaciers and valley glaciers as well.
How big is the resolution on those satellite images that you get?
So the the satellites that the Canadian Space Agency has are radar satellites. It's an active satellite that sends out a beam of radar energy towards the Earth, and then night or day, clear weather or cloudy weather, that energy penetrates down to the Earth's surface, bounces back up to the satellite, and it measures basically how long it takes to return and how much energy comes back. So because it's an active satellite in the way that it operates, the actual resolution varies from one part of the scene to another part of the scene. So that's the first thing we need to take into account, that it's not a straight, not every pixel is the exact same size. And then the other thing is, what we do with interferometry is we compare two images, digitally compare two images from subsequent passes, and we can see very, very minute changes from those images. So we're monitoring glacier flow right now in sort of millimeters per day type of resolution. So very fine. The 3D maps that we can create are in centimeters or decimeters in resolution.
So being able to monitor to such minute details, have you noticed any trends in, we're right now experiencing one of the warmest summers on the record in the Arctic. Are you seeing any trends in accelerating of the breakup of the ice fields and glaciers?
I think the biggest surprise that we've seen is not the acceleration. We're certainly seeing acceleration and melt. But the biggest surprise that I've seen is that the variability in that melt and unexpected processes happening. So, for example, the climate gets warmer, we expect glaciers to melt faster. But now, not only are the glaciers melting faster, but we're seeing weird things happen, like large lakes forming on top of glaciers because the water is being produced so fast that it can't escape. Or lakes that are dammed up by glaciers, catastrophically draining out and completely drying up a river valley or a lake basin in a matter of a couple of days, losing, you know, millions of cubic meters of water really fast. Or stream channels changing very quickly, or other paths, how the water flows through glaciers, changing in ways that we've never seen before, or that we wouldn't have anticipated happening. So it's just this variability that really is quite surprising.
Now, I understand that most of the research is done through satellites. How dangerous if you do this research in the field, if it, the situation can change so fast?
Well, that's a good question. And a lot of our work is using satellite data, but we also go into the field. I just got back a little while ago from Violet Island, as a matter of fact. We were camped on a glacier for 3 weeks this summer. And it's something we definitely have to take into account because things change so fast. A river could be there one day and it's not there the next. Crossing over a river to get to a study site might be easy in the morning and impossible to cross in the afternoon. And then we get these dry calving events where the ice literally falls from cliffs that are tens of meters high and comes crashing to the ground. So you got to be careful when you're around them. One of the things about Violet Island, it's in a national park. They don't get a lot of visitors at this national park, but we work with Parks Canada to advise them and make sure that they know the risks to any visitors that are going there.
In terms of rising sea levels, how are we seeing any surprises there?
Well, that's the purpose of this research that we're undertaking, is we want to refine what's happening with what the sea level is doing. And it's, you know, the sort of generalities that you see from some of the bigger ice caps, we're getting a better handle on, but we need to look at some of the details now, because I think we might see some surprises from that.
And in terms of you're studying these glaciers. For example, the ones that you've looked at, are they shrinking, or is just they're flowing out faster?
Both. They are definitely shrinking. So if you think of the way glaciers form, usually we usually divide them into two areas. There's the accumulation area, usually at higher elevations where it's just a little bit colder, there's less melt. And when the snow falls in the wintertime, it accumulates. And then in the summertime, there's less melt than the snow that accumulated in the wintertime. So it just keeps piling up. That ice piles up there, the snow piles up there, turns into ice, and then flows down slope towards the lower elevations. And that's what we call the ablation area, or the melt area. And that in the ablation area, there's more melt every summer than there is ice coming in or snowfall in the wintertime, because it's at lower elevation weather and the climate is warmer at lower elevations. So when I started studying on Violet Island, that's what we saw, and you could map out the areas where the accumulation was happening, and you could map out the areas where the ablation was happening. And I thought, this is an important science question, and we should get some more information on this. So I set up a series of automated weather stations in front of the glaciers, down in the ablation area, all the way up to some of the highest points of the island where the snow should be accumulating to feed these glaciers. And I thought, okay, the ones that are down low, they'll be fine. I can just go every year, collect the data, and I won't have to do much maintenance on them. but the ones up in the accumulation area, they should get buried by the snow that's accumulating, feeding the glaciers. So that was in 2001, and I've never had to dig out the station in the accumulation area.
Really?
Because there's just no more accumulation occurring on Bylot Island. All the snow that comes, no matter where it is on the island, all the snow that is deposited in the wintertime melts every summer. So as a result, all we're seeing is the glacier shrinking away. Some are shrinking away faster than others, but they're all shrinking away.
Why? How high is that mountain on Bylot Island? Why is it not accumulating?
It's the weather's warming up. Yeah, the highest elevation I think is about 5,000 feet above sea level, and then glaciers flow all the way right down to sea level.
That's pretty high. So it must get really warm there for all of the snow to melt away.
Oh yeah,
especially
yeah,
if it's sitting on top of ice already.
That's right. Yeah, and as an example of the strange things that are happening. We're not just seeing melt up there, but we're seeing these dramatic slush flows. So the snow starts to melt a little and gets really slushy, and then because it's in a mountainous area and there's slopes to it, it's these slush flows start to flow downhill. And a couple of years ago, we went up to check out the weather station that was up there. It's a small structure that's on a little tripod, you know, a few meters high. And it's got instruments hanging off it and this box where the data logger is. And we arrive there, and you have to get there by helicopter because it's so far away. We arrive there in the helicopter, and something looked weird about it. And sure enough, one of these slush flows had come down and ripped the door off this the data box, the instrumentation box. And so it was like, this has never happened before. That's strange. And then it came back this year, and... Because the glacier was starting to flow faster, these crevasses or cracks had opened up, and of course one opened up right underneath the weather station. And this tripod, it's got three legs that are sort of sitting on the ice, and they had frozen in, and because one side of the weather station was moving down slope faster than the other side, the crevasse had actually ripped one of the legs off my weather station. Yeah. So all kinds of strange and weird things are happening like that, we know that those processes occur, but they're happening more frequently and in areas that we haven't seen them occurring before.
And things like, for example, I mean, there are some models that talk about more precipitation in the Arctic if the, the weather continues to warm up like this.
Yeah.
Is this going to offset in any way the amount of snow that you're getting? It's pretty dry there.
Yeah, it certainly has the potential to. You know, if you go over to... So in the Canadian Arctic, we've got all these Arctic islands, and they sort of... they control how the ocean currents occur and how the sea ice moves. And so in the summertime, most of the sea ice in the Arctic Islands melts out, and so we have all this exposed ocean, and water can evaporate from the exposed ocean and turn into snow and ice precipitation. In the wintertime, though, what happens is all that ocean freezes over, and so there's no water to evaporate anymore, so that's why the Canadian Arctic is so dry. We call it a polar desert. If you go over to Europe, I'm thinking Svalbard and some of the islands north of Europe, where the Gulf Stream goes, this warm water that goes all the way across the Atlantic Ocean from the Gulf of Mexico, that water is just warm enough and is allowed to flow freely that much of the ocean up there, even though it's 80 degrees north, much of the ocean doesn't freeze over in the wintertime. And so all that ocean is still there available to evaporate. And so there's areas that they get much, much more snow than we get in the Canadian Arctic. With climate change, with the sea ice, the multi-year sea ice melting away and the open water season in the Canadian Arctic expected to be longer, the potential is for more snow and rain to be generated from all that period of open water. And so, you know, we may see changes, changes in the weather patterns that we weren't expecting to see.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, because I think it's one of the first things that strikes you when you're up there is how dry it is.
Yeah.
It's literally a stony desert in places.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, for example, when I started working up on Violet Island, one of the great things about it was we were too far north for mosquitoes. It was too dry and too cold, and we never had mosquitoes up there. Now with it warming up and more moisture around, we're seeing mosquitoes in the summer. They've actually migrated that far north now. The other thing that the other sort of aspect of my research is I study permafrost, the perennially frozen ground. And we think of the frozen ground is it's important because if it starts to thaw, in some areas there won't be any impact on the ground surface, but in other areas, if there's lots of ice in the ground, you know, it can destabilize and get landslides. Some areas it just literally turns to a liquid and flows away. So it's pretty dramatic. And this really affects people because this is where we have our houses and buildings and roads and airports and that kind of thing. And we were talking about the change in the amount of precipitation or snowfall, for example. Well, in the wintertime, the snow actually insulates the permafrost and keeps it warmer because any summer heat is trapped in there if you get more snow. So right now, because there's so little snow in the high Arctic, the permafrost is really cold and it's really stable. But if we start getting a lot more snow and it insulating it in the wintertime, keeping it warmer, we might see a lot more of this instability in the landscape just because of the temperature warming up, but also because of the change in the precipitation patterns. There's a lot of ramifications that are not direct, you know, not directly, or not as direct as you would anticipate they would be.